Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, is here with the latest from the legislature, including feedback on the county's budget presentation. Allegations of suppressed voter turnout in South Blooming Grove are under review by the New York Attorney General. Why investigators say residents never even knew an election was happening and what they uncovered inside Village Hall. Amazon's proposed $80 million tax break for a 3.2 million square foot warehouse in Orange County has hit a major roadblock, and local leaders are sharply divided. I'll tell you why a state monitor vetoed the deal and whether it could still survive. Plus, the latest episode of our theater podcast, Curtain Call, will have a preview with Tom Candela. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Several top lawmakers from both parties got new details yesterday about a U.S. military strike on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean last September. There are questions about a second strike on the boat that killed survivors of the first attack. Several Republican lawmakers say they support the Trump administration's effort to stop drug trafficking, although no evidence has been released to show who the people are. Connecticut Democratic Congressman Jim Himes saw the video of the military strike. He says these are suspects and potential criminals.
Killing people who we have traditionally arrested and interdicted is both stupid, because if you kill them, you can't interview them to find out who their bosses are, what the transshipment points are, what the routes are. You know, these are criminals. They are not terrorists. Terrorists have a political and a strategic objective. Narco-traffickers, as hideous as they are simply trying to sell a product to Americans.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. The congressional gerrymandering fight for next year's midterm elections is over for Texas. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing the state to use its recently redrawn map that could help Republicans keep control of the House of Representatives. But as NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports, the redistricting fight continues in other states.
In California, a federal court is set to hold a hearing this month on whether to block a congressional map that could help Democrats pick up five more U.S. House seats. California voters approved that map to counter the new Texas map that President Trump pushed for to help Republicans win five additional House seats. Missouri's Republican-friendly map is facing lawsuits and a referendum effort. New maps may be coming in Florida, Indiana, New York, and Virginia. And another wave of congressional gerrymandering may be on its way, depending on what and when the Supreme Court decides in a Louisiana case. During a rare second round of oral arguments for that case in October, the court's conservative majority appeared inclined to weaken the Voting Rights Act's long-standing protections against racial discrimination in redistricting. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning amid news of a blockbuster entertainment deal. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 160 points in early trading.
Netflix appears to have won the bidding war to buy the studio and streaming business of Warner Brothers Discovery for $72 billion. The deal would allow Netflix to produce more programs in the U.S. and give the streaming service access to Warner Brothers' vast catalog of movies and TV shows. The deal does not include Warner Discovery's cable networks, such as CNN and TBS. Netflix beat out rival bidders Comcast and Paramount. Cloud computing provider Cloudflare says it's resolved a problem with its firewall that was disrupting global traffic on sites like Zoom and LinkedIn. It's the second major outage for the company in 3 weeks. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up more than 170 points. This is NPR. The European Union is fining the online platform X about $140 million. The EU claims X has violated European law about digital transparency. EU authorities say that X's blue check marks are deceptive. They say anybody can pay to get a check mark and that X does not meaningfully verify who is behind it. Israelis are rejoicing as the Eurovision Song Contest has decided to allow Israel to participate in next year's competition. The decision prompted four countries to pull out of the contest over Israel's conduct in the Gaza War. NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi reports from Tel Aviv.
Israel has won the Eurovision contest four times and will now get the chance to compete for the title once more. The decision prompted the Netherlands, Spain, Ireland, and Slovenia to boycott the event. They said it was in protest for Israel's role in the two-year Gaza War, which has killed over 70,000 Palestinians. 2018 Israeli winner Netta Barzilai drew cheers at her concert when she called Eurovision's decision brave. "We must continue to shine and speak up," she told the crowd. Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, said Eurovision's decision demonstrated solidarity and fellowship. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Today's the draw for next year's FIFA World Cup men's soccer tournament. The 48 teams, including the U.S., will learn the other countries they will initially face. The U.S. is co-hosting the tournament along with Canada and Mexico. Those countries' leaders will join President Trump shortly for the tournament drawing in Washington. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And joining us on a Friday is Dan Hoost, Communications Director from Sullivan County Government. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah. Happy post-Thanksgiving to you.
We were talking about our Thanksgivings. Yes. We both had nice times. Thank you for asking.
Very polite. We did. Yes. No, you did something very interesting.
So yeah, we took a road trip. And now we're fast into the holidays and fast into budget season too.
And winter.
Yeah. And budget season.
And winter. Yeah.
You're seeing where I wanted to go here.
Yeah,
we want to talk about the budget.
I know. We got to talk about the budget. So,
well, let's remind folks about this budget. It was proposed, right? There was because of certain conditions which we can talk about, it proposed about a 9% increase in taxes. That was formally presented this week. Tell us more about the backdrop and how things went.
I told them, your PR guy's not happy with this 9.1% tax increase. I don't think other people will be too, but it was like, no, sorry, this is how the numbers have worked out.
Yep.
So it is. Listen, I don't mean to make light of it because this is something that it could have a heavy impact on people. We've estimated it'll be, I forget exactly what it is, but it's over $100 a year extra for every $100,000 of assessed value. Mm-hmm. Josh Potosik, my boss, the county manager, gave a presentation about it at yesterday's public hearing that happened in the middle of legislative meetings. It's a tentative budget that is proposed by his office based on his discussions with all our commissioners and department heads and constituency, and really trying to balance out the providing services that we need to provide, but also doing it in a way that isn't breaking the bank for people. 9.1% tax increase is not at all fun, although at one point it was over 15% that we were looking at, a lot of it because other sources of revenue, most particularly sales tax, have dropped precipitously. We plateaued last year at about $80 million. We're not even sure we're going to make $75 million this year. And while that sounds like a lot of money, we are talking about a $300 million plus budget. And there are only certain amounts of revenue that we can take in. We are not in the business of making a profit. And if we do, we have to reinvest that in the county anyway. So I can say from my perch that I think this has been approached very responsibly with trying to keep the taxpayers in mind, but also continue, like I said, to provide the services that people have asked for. We've dipped into fund balance, which is that rainy day surplus is what I call it. But we haven't exhausted that because we don't know what next year is going to bring. And with the kinds of federal cuts that have happened and the state cuts that we think are coming as well, we need to make sure that we still have a cushion for future years as well. So at this point, however, the 9.1% tax increase is not a certainty because the legislature has to vote on it. Tentatively scheduled for next Thursday that they're going to vote on it, but they could tweak it. It will become the adopted budget and thus the budget of the legislature when it is adopted. So they appoint Josh to put the budget together. But in the end, the legislators are the ones that are responsible because they're elected by the public to make these decisions. So we could see a decrease. I'm sure we're not going to see an increase in what the tax hike would be. But there is a chance if you want to say anything about it, anybody out there who's listening wants to say anything about it. The legislature office is already taking emails and phone calls about it, or you can mail them a letter if you want. But there's also an opportunity to speak in person about it this Tuesday at 5 p.m. in the hearing room of the legislature. We were originally scheduled to do this past Tuesday, but as we all know, we got snowed on. And even though the snow had stopped by then, the roads weren't that great. So we were like, abundance of caution, make sure we give people a chance to speak about this, because we know there are people who aren't happy about it, people who have questions about it. So your chance is this Tuesday at 5 p.m., or you can, like I said, give a call to the legislature office and talk to them about it there.
It was a public, the first public hearing yesterday. What was some of the reaction? What were some of people saying that did attend? And were there a good amount of people attending?
No. It was the usual crew of folks that we had. We had maybe five folks, I think, speak about it. A couple spoke about how they feel the county should weigh in more heavily against moratoriums in towns so that there can be more building in towns and thus create a larger tax base. But that's a home rule issue that I don't think the county is going to weigh in on. That's up to towns and villages to set their planning and zoning codes with that. And that wouldn't make any change with this current budget anyway. We're too close to the...
One of the things that was factored into why there's a need for this increase was a decrease in construction.
Yes,
as well as the sales tax, and that some of the people at this public hearing were alluding to the fact that some of these towns have moratoriums, which may contribute to that.
Yes, that's the point that they were trying. That is very logical. I am impressed.
sometimes.
So yeah, that was one of the cases being made, and then other folks made the case that, for example, we don't need to demolish the old jail. Somebody actually said they'd buy it from us if they wanted to, but we have a county courthouse expansion that we're looking at that's going to be mandated by the State Office of Court Administration, and one of the key sites they're looking at is behind the county courthouse, which right now the old jail stands in the way of that. There were other folks who were concerned about the idea of moving, for example, the Division of Public Works to our Maplewood facility, which we think will create a synergy of operations and open up more room in the government center for other offices, including some from Liberty that we want to move. That was discussed as well. I think legislators will continue to discuss that. There are folks we anticipate that will come on Tuesday that will talk about things that, you know, everyone has something that they think can be cut or changed or done differently. And listen, honestly, that is the case, but it's up to legislators to come to a consensus as to what they want to do differently. Josh simply proposes it. They then get the chance to determine, what are we going to do here and how are taxpayers going to be impacted, not just in their wallets, but in the services, the quality and quantity of services and programs that the county provides.
We've talked about the decrease in sales tax as a data point as to why there is a need to increase the tax levies. Is there any evidence or any data to support the lack of construction in the area as a reason for as part of the reason for this need in the increase? I'm just wondering if there's it's just more speculative, or is there actual data that the county's relying on to show as part of this mix of its sales tax, its construction decrease, its XYZ?
It's information we got. We got a spreadsheet from the state funneled through the county treasurer's office that showed exactly where the decreases in sales tax were. There were a huge list for several hundred different industry categories, but our number one sales tax driver has been building materials and construction. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the highest decreases. I think it was nearly 70% decrease in that year over year so far. And we're not finished with the year yet. And I think those numbers probably are current up to about June or July. There's a presentation Josh made. I'll be posting it today on county social media and on the website that goes into some detail more about that, so people can look at that. The budget itself is also available to look at, including in a cool interactive fashion where you can pick what you want to see and actually have the program chart it, graph it, make it into percentages if you want. Listen, I'm not a numbers person and I figured out how to use it, so it can't be that difficult to do, but you can take as deep a dive as you want. This is public. Nothing is being hidden there, but there are definitely things to discover as you take a look at it. And then coming to the public hearing on Tuesday and speaking to that, trust me, you will win points with the listeners if you have expressed that you know what you're talking about and you've done your research.
The legislative listeners.
Yeah, just coming to say I don't want a 9% tax increase, well, you're stating the obvious. Nobody does. Mm-hmm. Why don't you want it? What do you think that the county can do differently that would help ameliorate that? And you don't have to be a certified public accountant to be able to say something like that. People on that dais, the legislators, they do want to hear from the public. So if you have something that is well-reasoned, thought out, you've done your research, and you want to express that to the legislature, boy, do I encourage you to come out. Mm-hmm. Because that kind of public politician interaction in my world is golden, because you could be tipping them off to something they hadn't thought of before.
Were legislators just listening yesterday during this public hearing? Were they making any comment, or when does their discussion come up? Is that next Thursday?
They talked a little bit about it prior to the public hearing, and then there were a few questions asked, which, even though in a public hearing it's really for the public to address the legislature, they did answer some of the questions. Josh answered some of the questions, so I assume that'll continue again on Tuesday. With this legislature, I expect that if they do decide to vote on it on December 11th, they have till the 20th to do so. So that's why I'm hedging on there. But right now they're scheduled for that most of them probably will say something prior to their vote and to explain their vote. It might not be unanimous. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if it isn't, because a 9.1% tax increase hurts. Mm. But there are folks who feel that it's justified, it's what it needs to be, and there are other folks who in the public, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's reflected on the legislature too, is like, no, we can work out something differently with that. So it's something I've watched for the past 30 years of budgets with the county, and it's always something a little bit different. It's only in the really wonderful fiscal years that you get the unanimous consent at the snap of a finger. Most of the time, there's going to be discussion. There's going to be debate about it. Because let's face it, we are in a state that is a high tax state. And even though the county tax bill is pretty much proportionally one of your smallest property tax bills compared to what you get from some of the other taxing jurisdictions, it still has an impact. Mm. And so I just hope that people engage. But the thing I don't like to see is when we have just a small amount or hardly anybody come out. We have folks who are going to make it to every legislature meeting. We had them talking about it yesterday, and I'm glad they were there to say something about it. But I'd really like to see people who aren't there normally come out, ask questions, state what you think about it, get engaged with the process. Sometimes that's what creates new people who are going to serve on our town boards, our village boards, even on the legislature. Just ask Kat Scott. Mm. She started coming to meetings, and now she's a legislature. So don't let that scare you away, though. If you don't want to do that, still just come and interact.
We're talking to Dan, who's communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with an update from Monticello. Another big issue, another presentation from yesterday's legislative meeting, the Coordinated Transportation Services Plan overview was presented. A lot of folks know about the challenges of transportation in our county, mm-hmm. and some of the efforts that have been made, particularly with Move Sullivan. What were the findings here, and are we getting some new routes for the bus service?
It could happen. So that's up to the legislature. Right now, this is a plan that stands as a recommendation, an advisory plan. There is no obligation for the county to follow anything in it. But we did it because we want to improve the services that we offer, not just with Move Sullivan, by the way. We also have a senior shopping transportation service that we do in certain towns that we would like to expand as well. That is completely separate, independent of Move Sullivan. It's still under our transportation department, but it operates on a different schedule than Move Sullivan does. And it's open only to folks, I think, 65 plus or something like that. But this assessment of it was done by an independent consultant that we had hired and came up with all sorts of different recommendations on how to better connect our communities. For example, adding additional evening service to Move Sullivan, which has been something that's been talked about. Some people have talked about weekend service, but I think they identified that there's more need for evening services because our buses stop usually around 6 p.m. That doesn't mean people stop working at 6 p.m. who need that bus. They may need it later in the day. And not to say that weekends aren't necessarily on the agenda either. Also, adding an additional day of service for the senior shopping buses, because I think we only do it on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and that depends on where you are. For example, this service is offered mostly in the town of Delaware and town of Highland area, so we might be able to expand that. This was another one, maybe perhaps pilot an out-of-county medical demand response service. And also just a non-medical demand response service to places that we currently don't go with Move Sullivan, like Eldred, Calicoon, Narrowsburg, that kind of thing, where it's on demand. Maybe expand Move Sullivan over on a scheduled basis to the Grahamsville area. And also they even had, I really like it, they designed what looks like an enclosed bus stop. And it just has our logo on it. It's a nice little place to stay out of the weather, because currently we don't have any enclosed bus stops. You are out in the elements unless you can find a place to be out of the elements. So there's a number of different things. I have the coordinated transportation plan. I'm told the draft of it is being given to me today to put on the website. As soon as it is, I'm going to probably put a press release out about it so that people can see it and give us feedback about what it is. Right now, yesterday was a presentation by the consultant. It was just a PowerPoint slideshow, but there'll be the actual whole plan that we'll have available for public review and feedback.
And then that would go in for next year's budget, not in this current
Right. It still has to be finalized. It's only in draft form. Right. Legislators first heard about the findings and the recommendations yesterday, but they responded very well to it. It was a really well thought out, well researched plan, and I think it'll make a lot of sense to people when they see it. For those who support public transportation, there are others who are saying we could balance our budget just by getting rid of public transportation. I don't think that's on the agenda for the legislators right now.
County Clerk Russell Reeves reminding folks to sign up for property fraud alerts. What's going on with property fraud in the county?
Well, he said there is one case of property fraud. He didn't go into details because it's in litigation right now. But he also had brought some news articles that talked about property fraud across the country. And it's this pernicious thing. It's actually scary when you think about it. The property fraud happens when somebody pretends to be the owner of your property and tries to sell it or transfer it. And it can be done in a number of different ways. But basically, you know, someone's creating like a fraudulent document that deeds your home to them and then records it in the clerk's office. And the clerk's office, by law, must record all documents that meet the requirements outlined in New York State statutes. So if it looks legit, they have no ability to stop it or question it unless you have told them that there's a fraud going on. And how do you do that? By signing up for these property fraud alerts. It's a free service of the county clerk's office that helps the public protect their property by monitoring their documents. It happens automatically, being recorded in the county clerk's office. So if there's a document that is tied to you, your name or your business or something like that, you are going to get an alert if something is attempted to be changed with that.
But you have to sign up.
So you have to sign up. And frankly, I encourage everyone who owns property in Sullivan County to sign up for this. Everyone. Because while it happens fairly rarely, when it does happen, it's a big thing. It's basically, in my opinion, identity theft.
Yeah. So many scammers. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the latest about HEAP and warming centers and how you can donate blood. This is Radio Chatskill.
We believe nonpartisan, nonprofit news is essential to a healthy community. And as a Radio Catskill listener, we're guessing you feel the same way. We deliver fact-based journalism that holds the powerful accountable and keeps our community informed. Every story we produce is powered by listeners like you. And right now, through December 31st, your gift to Radio Catskill will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $1,000, by Newsmatch. Support local news and information. Give now at wjffradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and I'm joined in the studio by Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. We've got some good news about the HEAP program. It started back up on Monday after a roller coaster ride this fall about whether it's on or it's off. But now it's back, and folks can apply.
Yeah, we're so relieved because so many people depend upon this
it's so
service.
Cold.
So, and yes, this winter has really, December came and said, you know, it's supposed to be winter. And the cold, I woke up this morning, I had -4 degrees at my house. I could not believe that. So anyway, the Home Energy Assistance Program, HEAP, as it's known, is back in action. It opened up December 1st. for those who want to apply, you go to mybenefits.ny.gov. You can also call our HEAP office if you have questions or need help in the application, 845-807-0142. That's 807-0142. We have an office completely, totally dedicated to HEAP. These are very friendly people. They work with everybody to try to figure, you know, what kind of heating fuel do you use? What kind of heating system do you have? Who's your fuel provider? We could even work with wood and wood pellets. So a lot of more people than you might expect are eligible for this. The eligibility is the monthly income maximum for a household of just one is almost $3,500. For a household of a standard household of four, $6,680. The eligibility thresholds, I think, are pretty generous. And it also gets even better if you have a child under six or a adult over 60 in your household, or you have somebody who is permanently disabled. All of that can help raise those eligibility thresholds even higher. So I would encourage everybody just to check to see if they're eligible. You can do so online or by calling our office, and you may find out that you are eligible for up to, I think it's around $900 benefit, one-time benefit, that you can get to help pay for fuel to heat your home.
Some of the coldest weather of the season so far, I think the coldest perhaps.
Oh, yes.
Very cold today, a high of only 23. It looks like we'll get a bit of a reprieve on the weekend, but then Monday going down to zero. Mm-hmm. Warming centers are open in the county.
Yep.
Just remind folks where those are.
Listen, even if it was getting up into the 70s today, our warming centers would still be open because we contract with the Liberty United Methodist Church on North Main Street in Liberty and St. John's Episcopal Church on St. John Street in Monticello, along with the Federation for the Homeless in the Monticello location, to provide volunteers and bedding supplies and things at these locations from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. every night through at least mid-April. If we get a cold snap that continues into May, we might even leave them open longer than that. But no matter what the weather is, even if we have a little bit of a summer that tries to creep in January, I don't know that that'll happen, but if it does, those warming centers will still be open. We want that to be available reliably, consistently, that you could expect if you go there after 8 p.m. or before 8 a.m. any night through April, you are going to find people there who say, come on in, we've got a warm place for you to bed down.
And if you're listening to us outside of Sullivan County, a good place to start to find warming centers in your area is with your local county government. There are a lot of different structures in different mm-hmm. communities and different counties, so you can check there first. It's a good place to start. A good thing to do today, donate blood at the government center.
Yes. Yeah, I just took some pictures of them today. They'll be there till 2:30. The American Red Cross is collecting blood. As we speak, I hope they are collecting blood. There's always a deep need mm-hmm. for blood, but especially this time of year. They are going to be in the hearing room through 2:30 today of the government center. You do not need to pre-register. You can just walk in and they'll get you all set up, keep you for I don't know how many minutes it takes to draw blood, but probably no more than half an hour to an hour of your time. And they'll
total.
Be grateful, and you will have done a wonderful good deed for the holidays.
Yeah, it's always a need. Also, you might be able to hear some music if you come down to the government center today. Those holiday concerts are starting. Are they on now?
One should be starting in the next few minutes.
Minute. Yeah,
yes,
10,
the Chase 10. Elementary School, I think, fifth grade chorus is coming today. They will be our first. I'm missing that to be with you, and they know that because I can't miss out on my time with Tim. actually, we should call this Time with Tim, you know? Oh, no, it's Radio Chat Skill, right? Okay.
You turned to rebrand.
But I will be there at noon. We'll have another group coming in, and we have the complete calendar on the website. It's, I think, been in the media. It's on our social media. If you can't make it or not sure that you want to necessarily, the kids are wonderful.
They're wonderful.
It can get a little loud. I understand that. So if you're sensitive to loud noises, but that said, the kids do an awesome job. And no matter whether they're on key or off key, they put such love and hope and joy into it. You can't help but feel the holiday spirit.
Well, and the fact that there are so many of these programs throughout schools mm-hmm. throughout the county that are going just shows you the commitment to arts education, Plus. Music education in the area, which is wonderful.
Half the groups that we have today, I kid you not, their teachers called me before I put out the call to say, okay, let's figure out the dates and times you're coming. They're excited and they say their kids are excited. The parents are excited. Yeah. We get superintendents of whole schools come out and watch these things. And of course, our employees do. These are free concerts. The public can watch them. But as I was going to say, if you can't make it, I'm going to be recording as many of them as I possibly can, putting them on social media so that we can all get in the holiday spirit together. It is the most joyful, wonderful thing I do with the county, I think, or experience with the county. I don't do anything. I just set it up. I let them do the singing and the playing. But like I said, they bring such joie de vie to it, if I can use a French term. You were just in Quebec, right? So yeah. Well, you know what I'm talking about.
Did they say it like that?
I have no idea.
All right. Let's talk about more Dan time. You were at the family court's adoption day last week at the county courthouse. This is something very personal to you.
Yes. Yes. I'm not sure how many people know this or not, but I'm adopted. I've known it for my entire life. Only recently, actually, though, in the past couple of years, connected with my birth family. Didn't know them. They didn't. But back when I was adopted 50 years ago, it was a closed adoption process. But I always knew I was adopted, was never ashamed of being adopted, and really have always been a champion of adopting kids. And not just babies. I was adopted as an infant. I was about 1 year old when I was adopted, but we have foster kids in our system that also are looking for forever families, and we have people who are willing to adopt them, but we always need more. So family court, the judge, Jackie Ricciani, sets this up every year. She asked me to speak at it about a week and a half ago at the county courthouse in front of not just the families and the kids that are involved, but also the amazing staff that we have from our foster care unit right to our court system. And I got to share the story of my adoption and really sort of demystify it for some people, make some of the kids there feel more confident about, oh, this is a good thing. This could be a real wonderful thing. And to just tell everyone there how wonderful my life has been because of the family that adopted me, that really provided me a home in a way that my original family just couldn't have. Mm. And it's not saying anything against them. It's just they would say it now too, that it was just not, you know, I had teenage parents. It was a high school romance and they didn't get married and they ended up going their separate ways. It just wouldn't have been as good a life for me as it turned out to be with the family I was adopted with. So we have a wonderful team at the county that wants to make that story happen again and again and again. And I'm privileged to be part of the promotional team for that.
Yeah.
And I can speak from personal experience.
Well, and you turned out okay.
I hope so. You think so, Tim?
They done good.
You're not kicking me out, right?
Well, okay. We got to go.
Okay. You are.
Dan Hoos from Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure. Happy holidays, everyone.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the state is probing South Blooming Grove after only 6% of voters cast ballots in a recent village election. The red flags investigators uncovered coming up, and a proposed $80 million tax break for Amazon's massive Orange County warehouse is suddenly in limbo. A state watchdog has rejected the deal, sparking backlash, some praise, and a renewed fight over warehouse growth. Those stories next. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Cat's Cast, a shop in Catskill that sells vintage Catskills.
You told me 4 years ago I'd have a retail shop on Main Street. I'm like, you're crazy, because it's not something that was ever on my radar.
Plus, a community-based all-volunteer organization helping seniors who wish to remain safe and comfortable in their own homes.
They're just very good people.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now, a couple of stories from our friends at the Times Union. The New York State Attorney General's Office is reviewing allegations first reported by the Times Union that officials in South Blooming Grove intentionally suppressed voter turnout during the village's October 22nd election. Only 132 voters, or about 6% of those registered, cast ballots in the heavily Orthodox Jewish community. Residents later told state officials they didn't know an election was happening. Senator James Skoufis, who chairs the Senate Investigations and Government Operations Committee, launched a probe after receiving complaints. Radio Catskill's Patricio Barbio spoke with the Times Union managing editor, Philip Pantuso, who said investigators uncovered further issues.
This is a story that's kind of been in the news for a few days now, but we were able to advance it a little bit with some of our reporting that published on Wednesday. I think we were the first to confirm that the state attorney general's office is looking into this. But essentially, the village of South Blooming Grove, which is a heavily Orthodox Jewish community in Orange County, held its village elections on October 22nd, so about 6 weeks ago. And they had only 132 voters turn out for that election, which it was just 6% of those who are registered to vote. There are about 4,000 people who live there. And so that on its own was fishy. And after the election, a number of residents there complained to their representative, State Senator James Skoufis, who just happens to chair the Senate's Investigations Committee, saying, hey, we didn't even know this election was happening. Can you look into this? The state Senate opened an investigation doing just that. And what they found is that the village board had moved the election up to October 22nd from when it had been scheduled, which was for next March, March 2026. And they did that in a meeting, a special meeting that was not on the calendar that they announced with only 1 hour's notice. They had also switched the official newspaper, the paper of record where municipalities post public notices, to a weekly paper outside the local readership area. So those, to the Senate Investigation Committee anyway, seemed like clearly designed to sort of hide the fact that they were moving this election up by 6 months or so, or 5 months. So this investigation turned up other pieces of evidence suggesting that this was an intentional attempt to suppress voter turnout. I think it's worth noting as well that in October, the yeshivas in South Blooming Grove are closed. There just wasn't as much activity, probably not even as many people in the village when this election was going on. But some of the other evidence that they found were that they stopped posting meeting minutes, which is mandated by state law, and they made no mention of the election on their website, social media, in any kind of official emails or text messages, or by sending out any mailers. And during this investigation, state Senate investigators also had a phone interview with an unnamed village official who admitted that the election was moved to October due to the closure of local yeshivas. That's according to Senator Skoufis. So he took all of the Senate Investigations Committee took all of this material, has sent it up to the Attorney General's office, and Skoufis is asking that office to initiate what's called a quo warranto proceeding, which is a legal action that would essentially allow the state to invalidate these election results. He said that basically this was a sort of undemocratic attempt to suppress voter turnout. And so the Attorney General's office is looking into it. They haven't said yet whether they're going to do that or whether they'll actually open like a formal investigation, but they are indeed looking into it.
What are the consequences for the village if it's found out that, yeah, you know, all this stuff they did was illegal and this election was not valid?
It sort of depends what pathway the Attorney General's office takes. Like at minimum, if the Attorney General's office invalidates the results of the October 22nd election, then the village will be forced to schedule a new election. And I'm sure there will be a lot of scrutiny to make sure that they do things that are already required by law, such as posting meeting minutes and having proper sort of disclosure or meeting the proper disclosure requirements. If the Attorney General's office finds that someone here committed some kind of criminal activity, which nobody's quite alleging yet, then there may be further consequences. But at the moment, no one is exactly on the hook with any kind of like criminal liability or even any sort of civil fine. Though I would imagine that the current village board members who oversaw this process will be subject to some additional scrutiny by their constituents there in the village, who can make their voices heard at the ballot box.
And this is not the first time that South Bloomingdale has been in the news.
Yeah, there's a long kind of history there of tension, let's call it, between some of the elected officials and the Orthodox communities. So yeah, this just sort of is the latest in that story.
And another story that the Times Union is covering, a proposed $80 million tax break for Amazon's planned 3.2 million square foot warehouse in Orange County is now in limbo after a state-appointed watchdog rejected the incentive package, a decision that's sharply divided local leaders. Here's Patricio Rubio again with Times Union Managing Editor Philip Pantuso.
This is a complicated story, but basically Amazon is proposing this 3.2 million square foot warehouse in the town of Wada Yanda, where to use as a sort of distribution facility. And the County Industrial Development Agency, which is the authority that oversees these kind of large development projects, voted to give Amazon a tax break for that under what's called a payment in lieu of taxes or pilot agreement. Under this agreement, they would have paid about $48 million in taxes in a lump sum payment to Orange County, to the Minisink Valley Central School District, and to the town of Wada Yanda. And they pay it to the town and the school district because those, you know, they're making these payments in lieu of property tax payments, which of course also go to towns and school districts. That $48 million payment would have amounted to about $80 million in savings over the 15-year period of the pilot agreement. And, you know, there's a lot of controversy over these kind of pilot deals in general. You know, a lot of people think that they essentially amount to a handout to developers, development advocates, or people who say that these kinds of things, these pilot deals are good. They say that they're necessary because they're an incentive to attract developers to put big projects in your town as opposed to the town over, right? And obviously there's downstream economic benefits of that in the form of job creation and sort of, you know, ancillary spending that comes from those jobs being created. Nevertheless, I would say that tax breaks that the Orange County IDA in particular hands out have been subjected to a lot of scrutiny because of a lot of allegations of corruption within that agency. Circling back to Senator Skoufis here, probably the thing he has been most focused on since he's chaired the Senate Investigations Committee is how these IDAs use, and in his case, or in his word, abuse their authority to hand out these tax breaks. And he's taken a particular interest in Orange County. And we have a lot of reporting on that. I won't get into all of it here, but suffice to say, due to the Senate Investigations Committee's investigations of the Orange County Industrial Development Agency, about a year or so ago, the state appointed a watchdog who essentially monitors what they're doing. It's kind of like an ombudsman who is just sort of making sure that everything is above board there. And when this tax break was approved a month or so ago, we've all been kind of waiting to see what the monitor would say about that. And we finally got word on that late last week. He said he rejected the deal because for kind of a technical reason, actually. He said that both Amazon and the Orange County IDA had, quote, failed to provide adequate responses to his questions during the review period. It's not clear to us whether he objected to the terms of the deal itself. He didn't comment to our reporter when we reached out to him, basically said that he had not received sufficient information to make an informed decision. But of course, both Amazon and the Orange County IDA are firing back at him, saying that, on Monday, the Orange County IDA chief said that the veto is invalid because it arrived past the deadline and was, quote, completely devoid of any rational basis. And Amazon, through a spokesperson, told us that the monitor's decision was wrong procedurally and on the facts.
So what happens now with this project? Is it sort of dead in the water now, or can it be renegotiated or revived?
It remains to be seen. We're in this kind of state of limbo right now. Amazon said that it's working with the IDA to determine what its next steps are, because it's not clear to us exactly on what basis, other than this mere technicality, the deal was rejected. There may be some way that the monitor's concerns can be addressed, in which case the deal can move forward with this exact same tax break or maybe a modified version of the tax break. Conversely, Amazon and the IDA may be able to convince the state that this veto is in fact invalid and that, you know, this tax break was approved. It went through all the proper channels. There's this kind of extra watchdog layer on top that Orange County has to face that most other counties don't. And, you know, they may be able to make a successful case that that veto doesn't hold water now. We just don't know at this point. Yeah. So obviously something that we're going to keep watching.
It's been a big story for a while. It was part of my conversation with both candidates running for county executive, Steve Newhouse and Michael Sussman. Was one of the big things was they talked about, both of them talked about, was the warehouse. Michael Sussman talked a lot about how it was unnecessary and also talked about against the tax breaks. And Steve Newhouse talked a lot about the jobs it would potentially create.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, warehouse development, Orange County has been positioning itself as a kind of hub of this kind of large warehouse developments. It's particularly well suited for logistics, I think, because I-84 runs through there and I-87 and, you know, some of the longer and wider state routes as well. But yeah, you know, there are critics of this type of development, not just the tax breaks themselves, but they say that there are environmental issues, that there's some quality of life issues, et cetera. So yeah, it was probably the main issue in the Orange County executive's race.
And that is managing editor of the Hudson Valley Bureau of the Times Union, Philip Pantuso. You can read more of their reporting at timesunion.com. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And our Curtain Call Theater podcast has new episodes every Friday, including today. Today, Tom Candela sits down with theater maker and journalist Catherine Montese. Here's a preview of the episode.
My guest on the show today is Catherine Montese. She is a theater maker, a director, journalist, and arts advocate whose work blends accessible performance, community engagement, and meaningful storytelling. As an ensemble member of the Blue Laces Theater Company, she helps create immersive multi-sensory productions for individuals with autism and developmental disabilities, audiences who deserve to experience theater in a space built exactly for them. Her journalism with Missing Them, the award-winning memorial project honoring New Yorkers lost to COVID-19, shows us how storytelling can preserve memory, foster empathy, and serve the public in profound ways. And here at home, Catherine continues lifting up local voices through her work with the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, also known as DVAA. And she is also a fellow volunteer here at WJFF Radio Catskill. So, Catherine, I want to welcome you to Curtain Call.
Thank you, Tom. I'm so glad to be here, and I'm so glad this finally worked out.
So, let's start at the very beginning. What brought you to performing arts? What was the seed that sparked the interest and created this talented performer that we have sitting in front of me here?
From the time I was a kid, I have been putting on plays with my cousins. We had a costume trunk upstairs in our closet. And make-believe and play acting was just an important part of our play. Yeah.
But was there a time where that seed kind of grew where you thought you were going to take this on professionally? At what point in your life did that happen?
I had a theater teacher in high school, Michael Livaday. He was actually the theater teacher at the all-boys high school down the street. And that theater director, Michael Livaday, was pretty formative for me, and I think for all of us. But he really took us seriously. I mean, he really treated us like what we were doing mattered and that our work was important and worth taking the time to think about, and that we were capable of doing thoughtful, good work. I mean, for me personally, like, I felt invisible a lot growing up. I just felt unseen a lot. But there was really something about theater, and specifically about the way this theater teacher made me feel seen. It was like when I stood in the light on the stage, it truly felt like the light had come on for me.
Wow. And so you found your way to New York City?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Story Pirates, tell us about that.
When I first started with Story Pirates, the bread and butter of what we did was we would go into schools all over New York City. We would host writing workshops. We would walk students through the process of writing a story, a beginning, a middle, and end, character creation, and giving them total permission and freedom to be as weird, creative, and out there as they possibly could. No idea is too crazy for us.
Okay.
Unless it's violent, and we'll redirect it.
Okay. Yeah.
And so we would take their stories and we would go back to our office. We would adapt them into sketch comedy shows. We'd go back to the school and we would perform those stories for them with live music, with puppets, and the whole school would come out and it would make it a big to-do, be like, this next story is very exciting because the author is in this room right now.
And they would
all be like,
I'll be giggling and looking at each other.
We would ramp it up. The excitement would be so intense. And there is like are very few things, I think, more like thrilling than the sound of like 400 kids losing their mind with excitement.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
Yes. So you would take these stories.
Yes.
Not really stealing them, but, you know, borrow them.
Adapt them.
Adapt them. Good word. Adapt them for the stage.
Yes.
And for the kids. And the process would be what? You just start improving them? Or
yes.
Doing,
okay. Improv was a big part of this. It's a key part of how the process works. We get a story from a child, and these are students who are between first and sixth grade. So these are not perfect stories by any stretch of the imagination. A child wrote them.
Sure.
One of our most popular like stories that we did over and over again was called This is a Story About Cats Flying.
Okay.
Because that was what the kid wrote. They wrote, This is a Story About Cats Flying.
Cool.
And that was the only thing they wrote. And so we had all these cat puppets that did these choreographed dance. So our adaptations would always honor the spirit of the story, celebrating literally their words and their ideas and showing them what you wrote and what you can write mm-hmm. is actually worthy of an adult's attention and time, to the point that we are going to take it back, adapt it into a script, and perform it for you. And at the end of the show, we would get all the authors up on stage to take a bow.
Nice. So how did that work now with Story Pirates inform your later work as you moved into the Blue Laces Theater Company?
When I first started working with Blue Laces, I had not specifically worked with disabled or special needs population. It was just really revelatory. I just hadn't thought about, like, through this process, I had to encounter the question, like, who is theater for? Mm-hmm. Because we are making it in Blue Laces. We're making theater specifically really targeted towards audiences with autism, disabilities, and special needs. And once you start thinking about the needs of the disabled and autistic community, it's really hard to see the world the way that you did before. It just makes you realize how many obstacles there are to just day-to-day life that sort of don't need to be obstacles, but they're there just because the world is made for able-bodied people.
Correct.
Which is kind of funny when you think about it, because how many of us are truly able-bodied and for how long?
Mm-hmm.
That's really what got me thinking about like the beauty of making theater with the disabled community in mind, is that in a way you're really making theater and creating a world for your future self.
Wow. I love that thought. Yeah.
You are. You're really building the world, the gentle world that I want to be an old woman in.
What did you find in Blue Laces that you weren't finding in traditional theater?
What a great question. I found and have found consistently a greater willingness to play more quickly and a willingness to say yes.
Mm.
That is what this work does. It really, I think for us as artists, really helps sort of blow open any kind of limiting ideas or beliefs that we might have about theater, that ideas and that we don't even realize that maybe we have.
Right.
That was true for me, certainly. Sure. In a show like what we were doing with Blue Laces, this kind of theater, if I have a moon rock, I'm going to be like, wow, here's my moon rock. And I'm going to maybe say my lines about it. And then I'm going to turn to an audience member and say, do you want to hold it?
Mm-hmm.
Or here, take a look at this. Or I'm going to open a box and a light is going to come out of it. And I'm just going to let that happen and let all of them, the audience members, see that, notice it on their own and come to me.
So yes. It's inclusive theater, both sensory-wise and performance-wise, yes, within the framework of the script.
Because yes, we do have a script.
Yeah, you do have a script, but the challenge is for the performer is to keep it moving forward, mm-hmm, and yet still be inclusive, still make the audience member feel like they're part of this production.
Absolutely.
That they are part of the creative process.
Yes.
Well, let's talk a little bit now about your work with DVAA.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come about getting that job? Was this something you sought or it found you?
When I was finishing up my teaching artist residency last year, I was looking around for my next role,
mm-hmm,
and my boss, the director of education at Bethel Woods, Suzanne Morris, pulled me aside and said, DVAA is looking for a performing arts manager. I think you need to apply. And I'm going to introduce you to Ariel.
Nice.
Schoenberg, who's the executive director. And I said, okay.
Sure.
Yeah. I really didn't know. I was still learning and I'm still learning so much about the area.
Yeah.
But DVAA is so richly resourced in that we have a theater, a real theater with a roof. And walls.
Space.
Yeah. Yes. So many theater companies, that is the ultimate thing, is where to be. There hasn't been anyone in this role for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anyone has ever. I think the role is still being in a lot of ways defined. And that's exciting for me because I have ideas and hopes and plans and I'm wondering. But, you know, really, it's all about what the community wants. There's a real appetite here for visual art. There's an appetite for music and they like things that include them. And I'm excited to see what is exciting to people going forward. Like, what do they want from mm-hmm. theater? People really want more dance. They want more live music. They want poetry. Anytime I meet a parent, I ask them what they need. And the word is just more.
Nice.
Good.
Nice. And there's a lot of it, too.
There is. I thought there was maybe the market might be saturated, but every parent I talk to just shakes their head and says, no, more.
Yeah.
So, okay, great.
Let's go now to you are a volunteer here. How did you find your way over to WJFF?
I had an idea for a radio show while I was at Bethel Woods last year. Mm-hmm. We were, myself and two other teaching artists were collaborating on a curriculum. We were thinking about where we'd take them out to the festival field and play the Star Spangled Banner. We were saying, well, for the high schoolers, we should really make it two songs so they could compare them, a little more advanced, whatever. And so we were thinking about what other song could we use that would be sort of sonically different to use there. Sure. And we started a doc just with to throw a couple of song ideas, and this document got long very quickly,
mm-hmm.
and no two songs were the same. And we were just like, wow, what a great list of protest songs and protest music. And I was at Bethel Woods, so I was pretty steeped in protest music for a while. And I just thought, gosh, I would love this to be a radio show where we just go through these songs and just talk about the historical context and what the lyrics mean and all that. And so Kate Svoboda at Bethel Woods was like, oh, you should pitch that to WJFF. They're always taking show pitches.
Yeah.
And so I pitched it. And that was kind of how I met Tim and Jason and mm-hmm. how I got involved here. And then I came up here and then met the folks at Radio Catskill. I mean, they basically just, I walked in the door.
Right. They're very welcoming.
I walked right in the door and and I just said, oh, I'd love to be more involved. And they were like, great. Do you want to come back on Friday? I mean, it was as easy as that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just thought, wow, isn't it fun? Just when you think something is over,
A new door opens
yeah. that actually is exactly the thing that I really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm going after the things that are important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if a door doesn't open, I find another one. And if that door closes, I find another one.
You're doing it right now.
This is it.
So an ensemble member at Blue Laces, a journalist, arts advocate, and fellow volunteer at WJFF Radio Catskill, Catherine, I want to thank you so much for being part of Curtain Call today. It was great. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Tom. This was wonderful. Thank you for doing the show and all the work absolutely. That you do.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that's just a preview of the full episode, which is available now at wjffradio.org. Check it out under our podcast page. And our door is always open. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.